We're all good.
Are you in your office or at home?
No, I am at home. So my house is actually being repainted at. So I cannot stay in my home in Maastricht. So I'm actually at my mom's place because she offered so kindly that I could lend her office for today's meeting. So you see, it's such a special meeting that I traveled all the way to my mom's place.
Sylvia, your house is so small they could paint it in about 2 hours.
You would say that, huh?
Sylvia lives in the smallest house in Maastricht. It is literally, is it, it's really the tiniest house there?
It is. Yeah, three floors, three stories high, but nevertheless, I'm not as lucky with the painting at this stage. But don't worry, we have other challenges at our hands with COVID anyway, yeah? So is everybody at home? Nobody's in the office, it seems, huh? Everybody's at home.
Oh, yes. No, we are, Ken and I are in the office.
Yeah. Oh, you're in the office, yeah.
I just had my first class today. Just came from teaching face-to-face.
Really?
Face-to-face.
Yeah. With masks office. And everything.
Soon to be in the clinic this week.
Okay. Yeah, we are seeing a lot of patients face-to-face.
Mask to mask.
Mask to mask, yeah.
All right. Mm. Is Charnas, Cristiano?
Yes, I.
Claire? Johan?
Yep.
Sarah? Tatiana? Leah? Mike Suddy? The Tories? Tom Donaldson's there. Dan Savage. Bill Dunty. And I have everyone else, I think.
Dan Savage is on.
I'm on.
All right. Bill Dunty may not be on. He's having electrical issues at his house. Someone just signed on with voice. I don't know who that is.
Looks like Leah.
Hey, there you are.
Sorry.
What?
I'm sorry, I'm late.
You're all right. You look tired. All right, let's see. All right, so we got Michael, Claire, Sarah, Tatiana, Mike Suddy, and the Tories.
Tatiana's on another call. She's on her way back over now.
Alrighty.
Sarah's here.
I hardly heard that. Sarah's not, you're on just voice? Did anyone hear Sarah?
Yes, yes. Looks like she's yes. On the phone.
Yes, she said she was here.
Very quiet.
All right, so we have a fairly comprehensive agenda for today. And one of the areas that came up as being important, first of all, Tatiana won a big award. What award was it?
The Bell Tower, something like that award. It's very distinguished. Award for Indiana University, but she also got a new position of executive associate dean or something like that of science.
She got the new position, but then I heard she won a major university award. So we should remind me to congratulate. I sent her an email already, but congratulate her in public.
Ed, it's hard to hear you as always.
All right. I lean on the back. Bye. All right, I'm moving closer. All right, so that's the one item I wanted to mention. The other is our doodle poll for our November meeting, and I'll have to talk with Bill and Joe about that. But once again, we're having a difficult time trying to find a time when everybody is available. So we may ask people to see if they can shift around some of their other obligations. But one of the areas that came up in terms of, oh, Kathy Mitchell. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, Ed. Hi, everybody.
Good to see you
guys. Long time no see.
I know. Tom's been handling all the, you know, the troublemakers here.
Today's call hopefully will be of interest. So one of the items that came up in the ideas for CFAS 5 and moving forward, and everyone thought, or there was pretty wide consensus that stigma was an important area that we should assess to see whether or not this was something that CFAS could deal with and how we might do it. And Sylvia Rusin had recently published a paper, which I think was sent out to everybody, on stigma and FASD. And so I asked Sylvia if she would kind of present for 20, 25 minutes on what her findings were and possible ideas for looking at stigma in the FASD arena in the future. And then Ken Jones has been an advocate for assessing stigma for quite some time within CFAS. So I asked him to participate as well. And then all of that really was fostered by Tom and Kathy, who have been bringing up this idea for quite some time. So I've asked them to, if they would address. And then NIAAA also is interested. And so Bill, if he can get on, he's having electrical issues at his house, is also going to be presenting. So we've only got an hour and I want to run right into it. So Sylvia, if you want to share your screen and unmute yourself, we'll go from there. And if everyone can mute themselves, that would assist.
Thank you, Ed. And I trust this introduction of yours doesn't reduce the amount of time that I have on my hands right now. So thank you for introducing me and welcoming me to this group. So the prevention of FASD-related stigma. So as Ed already mentioned, I am from Maastricht University in the Netherlands. So very small country, but also we always have lots of ideas and limited amount of time at our hands, and so do we have on this meeting. But today, just as a brief overview, what I will discuss is just an introduction, also the introduction to stigma in general, to FASD and stigma, reduction strategies, and some recommendations for research and practice, and the way forward, which I welcome your questions and discussions afterwards. So FASD is, of course, an important topic and, of course, also relevant to the Sustainable Development Goals. And one can imagine the different aspects that come to it. And if you look closely also to the work that we have done in our field, a lot of reports have been published and we also have tapped onto the problem of stigma. But what is stigma? So you see alarming messages in the news about women found guilty or had that they want to make women in a criminal offense for the damaging effects of the Amber Gold. But of course, there's more to the story than just that. So if we think about stigma, for me, it's part of prevention. It's not only primary prevention, because that's often what is believed, but prevention is also taking care of those who are experiencing a condition. So that is secondary and tertiary prevention. And today we're talking about stigma towards different groups, different people, and also different aspects of prevention. When thinking about the word stigma, it comes from even from the Roman and Greek time period, which I'm not sure if you knew. So stigma was actually something which is depicted on the little image below on my slide here, is tattooing somebody, so benchmarking people. Benchmarking people is something that we do, not literally as you see in the old days on the picture, but benchmarking people to put them in a box, to really exclude them from others and stereotyping. So what does that mean as a process? That means that people are first identified as being different, like the blue fish is an example, and then they are devalued, leading to status loss and discrimination. So this is just a short term of what is now perceived as stigma and stigmatization. The process of stigmatization is one of a psychological process. So you start off with a situation or that you meet somebody, you have perhaps stereotypical thoughts about that situation, which may trigger an emotional response or a prejudice, which then leads to discriminative behaviors. So this is to get an idea of, if we think about stigmatization, what is then the process? I'm not sure if you knew this already also, that there are functions of stigma. There is a reason why people stigmatize. Three functions I depicted here. So one is to keep people down. So stigmas help people to legitimize and perpetuate social inequities and to provide justification. But it also helps to make people conform. So to enforce social norms by serving as a punishment to those who choose non-conformity. You also have a function of to keep people away, that triggers avoidance responses to broad class of deviant human characteristics. So you see, stigma has actually also a function, and this is why people stigmatize. Who are stigmatized? Well, here you see from the Dutch Society of Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorders, some of the faces. There are some experts, some people with FASD. There are biological parents, also non-biological parents. But if we look at the literature, we see there are actually three broad categories. On the one hand, we have women who consumed alcohol during pregnancy, who are being stigmatized. On the other hand, non-biological parents, and of course, individuals themselves with FASD. Looking closer to the topic of stigma, this is just to show you that there are four types of stigma. So the most studied part of stigma is public stigma. But public stigma, that's not the full story either, because we also have self-stigma, the internalized beliefs, structural stigma, and stigma by association. And you see they all are interrelated and interconnected. I'm just going briefly over all the four parts, and then provide recommendations thereafter. So for the public stigma, you may think about people's cognitive affective behavioral reactions to a person they perceive to have a stigmatized condition, they perceive to be different. As has been studied also by the colleagues, by Ken Jones and with Mitchell, there are stereotypes of children with FASD, for example, that they have a bad prognosis, that they are immature, retarded, and of course, these are not my words. These are the words that people have identified for as stereotypes about children with FASD. You can also have stereotypes about biological mothers of children with FASD. This is also part of public stigma. For example, that people find guilty for drinking during pregnancy, or they are ignorant to their pregnancy, or perhaps they deserve harsh judgment. So these are all types of stereotypes. This is also relevant for non-biological parents. And non-biological parents can also be held responsible for the child's disability. And even women have reported feeling blamed when the child has shown difficult behavior because others would likely to consider them as being bad parents. This is a study that was conducted, and you must know this as well. This is a famous budget allocation task where people perceive budget on 10 different topics, and then the proxy is that the budget allocated to some of the topics, such as mental illness or substance use disorders or FASD, that's a proxy of discrimination. And you see here that FASD was the least allocated budget to, so therefore, discriminated the most. Moving to self-stigma. Now, self-stigma is more of the impact of possessing a stigma. So that means the apprehension and the potential internalization of the negative beliefs and feelings associated with the stigmatized condition. The self-stigma among biological mothers is including self-blame, holding yourself responsible, feeling guilty, and note these are often caused by the fact that people were unaware or that even doctors would tell them it's okay to drink. For self-stigma among individuals with FASD, the internalization could take place of negative beliefs, and lower self-esteem and lower self-confidence are then a consequence. And of course, this is an underestimation of your own potential. Stigma by association is the third category of stigma, whereas the social psychological reactions are happening to people who are somehow associated with a stigmatized person. So the associates of a person being stigmatized. For biological mothers, that would be a double burden because they are already stigmatized for drinking alcohol during pregnancy. And now also as they are associated with having a child with FASD, it's a double burden. For non-biological parents and guardians, it's also a feeling to compel to disclose that the child is disabled or has a handicap or has a disability of just a behavioral component. So this is also stigma by association that you feel you need to tell people. Structural stigma, on the other hand, is a bit more complex because it reflects and legitimizes a perpetrated by society's institutions and ideological systems. So what does that mean? That means coercive and punitive measures. And these measures could be, for example, the removal of parental rights, of criminalization of women who consumed alcohol during pregnancy, as you could see earlier. Another part of structural stigma is the use of public health initiatives. And we are now doing so well in providing our prevention measures, but we often emphasize on the risk of children or the risk to children and the responsibility of mothers as an individual. So even though these are well-intended supportive approaches and providing information that we would say that people would then think twice of drinking alcohol during pregnancy, they are very framed negatively. And negative message, we know, it's impacting the woman's autonomy and will be less effective. Marginalization is the third aspect of structural stigma. So that means having less access to healthcare, for example. So if we think about stigma reduction strategies, one must think that of multi-level approaches. So only targeting at the individual who has experienced stigma, that's not effective. Only focusing on the interpersonal environment, that is also not effective. It's not easy to change stigma, and we always emphasize on these different levels of the social ecological model. Reducing public stigma and stigma by association. I take these two together. Why? Because often people who perceive public stigma are also having the same determinants as stigma by association. So what has been done already? Education programs, one can think of. So challenging inaccurate stereotypes, or that is important to have correct knowledge about the stigmatized conditions. Okay. Another way to think about it is personal contact. So the interpersonal contact with members of a stigmatized group and having more empathy for one member. So these two forms of interventions have been found to be effective, not for FASD, not for our stigmatized group, but for example, mental illness. Reducing self-stigma, then you can think more about the cognitive behavioral therapies and empowerment. Reducing structural stigma, one can think of media advocacy, and one can think about agenda setting. But although that efforts to reduce public and self-stigma are really needed, they are less likely if structural stigma remains. So it's very good to think when we think about prevention to also focus on structural stigma when focusing, for example, on public stigma only. What is needed is definitely a good timing to put the issue on the policy agenda and making and maintaining laws and regulations to foster inclusion and protect the rights of people with FASD, of women who consume alcohol during pregnancy, but also the non-biological parents. So in general, the recommendation is, well, first important to mention, of course, that prevention is not easy, in generally not, because if it was easy, we would have overcome already the birth of many, but it's the origin that actually lies in the perception and beliefs held by the target population. And changing those perception and beliefs, that requires behavioral change approaches. And we know from different fields that that is not easy to do. this is just to show you that from my perception, I have held many beliefs about older women and sitting in chairs and looking at flowers the whole day, but less is true. I mean, we have a different range of people in the older category, and this is just to show you that we can have stereotypical ideas, but unless you have seen the opposite, you will remain to have those ideas. So again, behavioral change is needed, but extremely challenging. Of course, perhaps one can think immediately about solutions, but it's not about the solutions at this stage. We first need to identify what is needed of specific determinants underlying the different types of stigma, but also think about effective implementation of stigma reduction methods, because often the parameters of use or effectiveness are not taken into account. So this is important to keep in mind. This is a cartoon, it's a Dutch cartoon, and I'm not sure if this is now inappropriate or appropriate, but I like it because it shows that we always try to put prevention in general, but now also FASD-related stigma prevention, just on the schedule like today. And then we think we can move the world and we can change the field and influence the processes of stigma just by adding it to an agenda once or twice. But of course, that's not sufficient. I like always to quote Erasmus, because as a philosopher and being a scientist myself, I always like to think, okay, if we look at the problem of stigma now, if we look at prevention aspects, and if we look at the opportunities given the limited resources that we have at this stage, what can we do? So that means festina lente, take it slowly, look at what we have right now, which is not a lot, and see and define what needs to be done, which I have heard now that we will do later on. One thing that we have been using is a systematic approach. If anything, we must rely on tools that are available already and we can just apply in the real setting. This is just one approach that we have been using and we are still using for behavioral change and for prevention measures, but it just shows you that a systematic approach is highly needed also when it comes to FASD-related stigma. The literature on FASD-related stigma is still in its infancy, as you could guess perhaps already. There is a need for reduction programs, but these need to be theory and evidence-based, otherwise we don't know if it works. So we need to have valid and reliable measures. Content of interventions need to be clear, and of course evaluation needs to be happening based on high methodological quality, and the methodological quality is often also a bit doubtful. So looking at those interventions is of course good to pilot interventions before implementing them and evaluating so we understand why some measures work and others won't work. And this takes a collaborative approach to go forward. So my recommendations now is for public stigma to investigate beliefs held by the general population about alcohol dependence, women who use alcohol during pregnancy and FASD. For self-stigma, that is exploring to the extent to which society's negative beliefs are anticipated and internalized, as well in which it impacts the psychosocial well-being. For stigma by association, investigating experiences of stigma by association for among those connected to individuals with FASD would be worthwhile to do. And for structural stigma, identification of structures contributing to FASD-related stigma, but not only identifying the structures, but also to see how they are interlinked together. So with that, I thank the collaborators also that I have the pleasure of working with. The International FASD Interest Group is also very pushing forward the topic of stigma and the topic of FASD prevention in general. And these are the co-authors I had the pleasure of working with on the paper, on the recent review article that I show here. And for your interest, you can look it up. So thank you for your attention and I welcome any question.
Thank you, Sylvia. And I hope I didn't rush you. You had your full time. My introduction just sometimes go on a little long. So I'll open it up to any questions that you might have for Sylvia.
So I did, thank you, Sylvia. I thought that was a terrific, both an overview of stigma in general and regarding the FAS. And I'm wondering about how specific research questions might be formulated at this time. You know, so, are specifically to FASD, I mean, are there people who are studying how to reduce self-stigma in that group? Are there barriers with this particular group that might make whatever the general strategies for reducing stigma less effective? And you talked about the determinants of stigma as well. I mean, have those been investigated, or how might somebody investigate those in FASD?
You're muted, Sylvia.
Thank you, Ed. I was just somehow the stream mixed up. Thank you, John, for asking the question. This is an extremely difficult area, because I have the feeling of those working in the field of prevention in generally, and also specifically to stigma, the focus has always been on public stigma. That's because public stigma is always something that we are aware of, but self-stigma not. So self-stigma comes up now and then, but has not been investigated sufficiently. So the research questions are therefore very generalized to identify and to explore further for the three different groups, the three different target groups, to identify what is now the self-stigma that people feel and experience before one can think about solutions and what we can do about that. So that is just a very brief answer to your question, John.
Anyone else? Raj.
So Sylvia, that was a really nice presentation, and I was not aware of that paper that talked about placing value on different problems with budget. It seems like there might be creative ways to operationalize stigma by value, studies about value or something like that. But one of the questions that I had is, with that particular study, could something like just awareness, people might think, for example, that cancer, for example, is a huge problem because everybody talks about it. And so awareness might contaminate value judgments as well.
Thank you for that excellent question, because that is what we always believe, that if we increase awareness, then people must understand, and people must see how important it is not to put emphasis on the stigma. But by raising awareness, sometimes we even provoke stigma unintentionally. So awareness alone, I'm afraid, in prevention area in general, will not change our behaviors. That would be too simplified if it would be, because if it could be, then we would have solve the problem there. So by raising awareness, we don't immediately take in account the different beliefs that people held or people hold that underlie why we stereotype and why we discriminate. So people might hold different beliefs. We can think about norms, we can think about a risk perception, we can think about perceived norms, to be more specific. But we don't understand what these determinants are. So even though we don't know that, awareness wouldn't help sufficiently, and one way forward could be to understand these determinants of the audience, of the society, much better. So that's just one way of addressing your question, Raj.
All right, I'm going to try to move this on to Tom and Kathy next, because I think they brought this up first, then Ken, and then Bill. And then open it up for a general discussion and all for questions for everybody at the end, if that's okay and no one has any problem with that. So Tom, Kathy, your input onto this issue and any possible solutions or things that you think really need to get done that CFAS should think about addressing.
Well, thanks, Ed. First of all, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great. First of all, I mean, my attention to stigma around this issue and everything I know about it, it comes from Kathy. And I think maybe all of us or many of us can say the same. I just want to make a couple of points when it comes to how we talk about FASD and messaging, and then maybe what CFAS can do to address it. Because, I mean, the stigma... established.
I'm getting a whole bunch of static from somebody. I don't know who it is, so we can start again. Everybody else can mute.
Okay, I'll proceed. I didn't hear anything on my end. Hopefully it isn't, but and the other point, other than the birth mothers, obviously the stigma faced by the individuals when they're faced with the inability of systems to recognize and manage the condition and many other factors. But when we talk about the issue and when we do messaging at NOFAS, we first look at the fact that there have been many successful health initiatives and social movements that were designed to stimulate or intended to encourage stigma or blame by assigning responsibility and even setting up sort of a perpetrator versus victim scenario. Think of Mothers Against Drunk Driving and really reshaping the way society looked at the drunk driver, or by looking at the smokers and focusing on the secondhand smoke so that they then had a victim that they were harming. I think though, however successful prevention messages on FASD might have been, the messages and images or any narrative that portrays the woman drinking alcohol as the perpetrator or wrongdoer or the exposed individual as her victim obviously feeds the stigma. So you may be preventing and raising some awareness, but you're also encouraging stigma. When we think of the prevention messages or even a conversation, there are often two parts to that. The first is the justification, rationale, or your science that demonstrates the problem. And then the second part is the recommendation or advice for addressing the problem. So 1 in 9 pregnant women drink alcohol. Women should abstain from alcohol during pregnancy is the advice. Well, the problem with this is when a woman violates that rule, some in society believe she should be blamed for doing so and that she herself should feel shame for having done so. So instead, we think of eliminating the recommendation or object of responsibility for addressing the problem, such as saying, 1 in 9 pregnant women drink alcohol. Half of all pregnancies are unplanned, for instance. Or 1 in 9 pregnant women drink alcohol. Many women don't know they're pregnant for 4 to 6 months. So you're removing the person being responsible, the woman being responsible. You can also reassign this responsibility. 1 in 9 pregnant women drink alcohol. Doctors should tell or should talk with expectant parents about the risk of alcohol in pregnancy. So what I think what we need to do and what NOFAS strives to do is focus on the part of the message or narrative where you assign responsibility for the problem and not make that the woman. Now, just the second point I wanted to make was CFAS. I think it's important to not overlook the fact that in many ways you already are addressing stigma. I think whether it's Claire developing an intervention and training parents how to use it, whether it's Christy's app for families or Sarah's decision tree or screening app, I think I can think of Jeff working with Proof Alliance and other non-scientists in Minnesota. You know, when you all go to the Vancouver conference, I mean, for goodness sakes, you're all rock stars at conferences like that where you have the families. But when you do that, all of these things do help to reduce and alleviate the stigma because you are developing tools, guides, products that have a real world application. Now, I guess in an ideal situation, there would be a fully funded structure so you could hand over your research to those who could do that. But I believe that CFAS has been very attentive to this concern and nimble in addressing some of these efforts to translate the science itself, the coalition itself, so that you have these tools that can then be put in use. The last one I want to make is this year there was a very modest additional $1 million that was appropriated for HRSA to address FASD. Now, that money came about because of your work, because I can go in and other advocates, and we did a year and a half ago, and talk about the issue, and I can now answer questions that in the past I couldn't. So that a policymaker says, okay, I see this is significant, and I see it can be addressed, and we can make progress, and we can begin to or continue to meet the needs of those who are affected. So money was put in, and that money is now into the system. Now, earlier this year, we had then an exponential increase in the number of offices who were willing to consider an even larger increases for the types of work that should come after or should be informed by your science. We hope that isn't scuttled by the need for COVID stimulus and relief. But I think that, as I started by saying, don't overlook what you are already doing. I think interacting with the community, not just going to their meetings, but you know whether it's the RSA work group, you know, having not representation, but bringing in people who can talk about the stigma and issues they face are all progress.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Kathy?
Yeah, I'll be brief. Is that what you were going to say?
Nope. I said I'd like to hear from you. But
oh, wow. Okay. Thank you.
I'll cut you off in about 5 minutes now. All right.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, well, of course, I think everybody knows that I've had the privilege and honor of working with Dr. Jones on this topic and done a lot of work. And certainly it's something in the very early days of the FAE task force, when we called it that, I brought this up as the most important issue. And so I'm glad that finally it's being listened to. The COVID disaster brought some good things to our world, or at least to my world. I started a program called Recovering Mothers Anonymous, and it was designed to be a 12-step program for any woman with a lived experience. So she doesn't have to be, somebody who's struggled with an addiction to alcohol or drugs, or she could be. And it's really taken off. We meet every Thursday, and we have women from all over the world, actually, that attend. But mostly the United States, because of the timing is so difficult. But I did, when I found out, and hi, Sylvia, good job. It's good to see you again, that Sylvia would be presenting today. I went ahead and had a lively text message with a lot of the gals that attend that meeting. And by the way, we have some young women that we have one young lady that's due next week. And so she joined our group and was pregnant and has managed to stay clean and sober and just been, had a lot of support from all the women. But anyway, so I just wanted to take a minute to read you some of the things. What I asked them about, what are your thoughts about stigma? What would you like to say to the researchers and suggestions for what should be looked at? So I'm just going to read some of the responses I got. In terms of stigma, a couple of people offered that not researching paternal effects is actually part of the stigma, that, you know, sometimes people will ask in open forums, what are there, a bunch of male people that run the research department? Because why are we still only looking at effects that from women that drink? Why aren't we ever talking about the men? And we never seem to have any true facts about that, but I guess it's a man's world. So you hear those, I'm sure you guys have heard it. I hear it. Not screening women for alcohol, and certainly not identifying, somebody said, well, if the conversation came up that the researchers were part of NIAAA, and so the question is, why aren't more physicians more knowledgeable about FASD, but also more knowledgeable about identifying symptoms of addiction, of a substance use or alcohol use disorder. And they feel like that's part of the stigma, because so many women, part denial is part of the process of that, so they report to be social drinkers or periodic drinkers, when in fact, you know, maybe the amounts, maybe it's periodic with large amounts, but they're not well educated, and women aren't getting the help they need. And then somebody brought up, well, if people don't understand why a woman would drink, well, of course it's going to be stigmatized, which I also believe that to be true. So if we just think, oh, this woman just doesn't care and she's drank again, well, that would indicate somebody that's out of control. So that's not able to stop on their own. So again, that was part of it. Not building in, you know, we work with the CDC, and we, part of our stigma project that has stemmed from Ken's, initial stigma work, is now looking at how to change stigma and bias among OBGYNs and pediatricians. So we work with ACOG, and they go in and do grand rounds, and then we match a birth mother up with the OBGYN. And in that contract, there was no money to pay the women to speak. And that's always been one of the, you know, issues that occurs. And a lot of these women have to take off work. They have to pay the babysitter. It's not easy. You know, they work in jobs that they can't easily take off oftentimes. And so the big question is, some of our birth mothers, we have a physician, we have a psychologist, we have an attorney, and when they hear that, they're like, oh, no thanks. If the government can't even build in time to reimburse me, then I'm not interested. So these are some of the things that we deal with. To be researched, again, it came up, paternal effects, nutritional interventions besides choline, for both mother and for baby and or individuals living with FASD. The younger women talk a lot about the marijuana, use of marijuana and alcohol and sometimes opioids, but definitely the marijuana and alcohol combination is something that they see. A lot of these gals work in the field also of helping women. Another woman brought up the children that siblings of someone with an FASD that don't get the diagnosis but have mental illness, and, you know, really redefining, are they really capturing people that, have, ARMD, when you get the point. So the question is, how many of those children actually have ARMD that it's just not being captured? So that's it. And the other piece that I just want to say in closing is we do have women that are in recovery. Of course, recovery is the way to address self-stigma. And we have, the proof of that is people living, lives that quality lives where they've gotten through the self-stigma. So I think that the opportunity is there. And we have some women that are more than willing to work with researchers. And so, that's always the message is, hey, we welcome them into our world. Please, ask us, because they have the stories, they're living the stories, and they have the answers if we ask the right questions. So anyway.
Thanks,
Kathy. One other thing that came up, I just have to say this. I know you guys really don't work in this field, but in many situations, the only treatment that is offered to women with little resources and not, you know, where they have state health care, they don't have good health care, is medication assisted treatment. And that's another big topic amongst this group, because we have some women that were on medication and, you know, some it helped short term, but the idea that women need to be on medication for the rest of their lives on narcotics is not something that's welcomed mostly by this group. But it's, you know, for people that have resources, they can go to Betty Ford or Hazleton or what have you. But for many of our women, they were never given options that don't include medication. So.
All right, Ken, you want to unmute yourself and add your comments?
All right, thanks Ed very much for giving me the opportunity to talk about this. And I'm going to talk very briefly about what we have done in our division about stigma in the recent past and what our immediate plans are for the future. My introduction to stigma came from Kathy. She made me aware of how devastating it is to biologic mothers of affected children and how we can never prevent fetal alcohol spectrum disorder without dealing with and preventing stigma. About 5 years ago, I met Pat Corrigan, who Sylvia mentioned, who is a distinguished professor at the Illinois Institute of Technology, who has been involved in research on stigma for many years and is editor of the journal Stigma and Health. The thing that led me to Pat was his interest in developing strategies to actually prevent stigma as opposed to just document it. Pat has focused primarily on stigma with respect to mental illness, and this is the first step he has taken into stigma as it relates to fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. along with Pat, Kathy Mitchell, Peggy Combs-Way, and Diana Sims, I applied about 5 years ago for and got funding from the CDC to study stigma. And between 2017 and 2018, we published 3 papers on the topic and we developed a stigma prevention program. Although we have not completely fulfilled each of the 6 steps of the intervention mapping approach that Sylvia briefly just described, I think we have included most of the planning steps related to stigma, at least from the standpoint of the medical profession, at least from the standpoint of public stigma. The purpose of the CDC funding that we received was to establish a stigma prevention program initially focused on pediatricians and obstetricians who I have been told stigmatize pregnant women and affected children probably more severely than anyone else in society. In order to do that, we started off by identifying a community-based participatory research team. The team was made up of 9 members of the community who worked for 1 year on this project. The 9 members included 2 biologic mothers of children with FASD, 1 adoptive mother, a researcher, and 4 healthcare providers, 2 of whom were primary care pediatricians, and 2 of whom were primary care obstetricians. Among other things, the community-based participatory research team established 5 focus groups, each of which meant for 90 minutes once a month for 4 months. And there were 5 types of people who were recruited for the 5 homogeneous focus groups. One was a group of adults with FASD. A second group was biologic mothers of children with FASD. 3rd were other relatives of children with FASD that included adoptive mothers. The 4th group were primary care pediatric health care providers, and the 5th group were primary care obstetric health providers. Based on the knowledge gained by these 5 homogeneous focus groups, we developed a stigma reduction program initially aimed at physicians. So based on Pat Corrigan's expertise and experience with stigma, we utilized a stigma reduction methodology that uses a contact intervention approach. In this case, contact interventions challenges stereotype by providing a lived experience of being the biologic mother of a child with FASD, followed by interactions with a target audience who in this case were pediatricians and obstetricians. I have, over the last few years, been a member of that target audience on numerous occasions when Kathy Mitchell has related her lived experience. And I'll tell you that within 15 minutes of starting, Kathy is able to put the target audience in the palm of her hands. And within another 5 minutes, pretty much everybody in the audience is in tears, and frequently Kathy's in tears as well. It's amazing. It's an amazing transformative experience that at least anecdotally has made incredible changes in physicians' perspectives of FASD and the stigma associated with it. We are now in the process of applying for pilot funding through the University of California San Diego Institute for Compassion and Empathy for a $100,000 per year grant that would last for 2 years, that will allow us to get objective preliminary data on the validity of this stigma reduction program that we have developed. Thanks.
Thanks, Ken. Hopefully you get that money, or that Sanford money, I think, right? Or
Burnham? It is.
Sanford, yeah. All right, Bill, are you there?
I am. Hi,
Bill, Joe. Bill, I asked you if you wanted to make some comments on NIAAA's involvement and issues about stigma, so you're on.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I would say that NIAAA staff at many levels are keenly aware of this issue. That includes program officers like myself and Joe, who keep it in mind when we're putting out funding opportunity announcements or assessing grant proposals. Folks in our science policy and communication office, who some of you have worked closely with, they definitely keep this in mind when we put out any kind of NIAAA publication or fact sheet or press release. In fact, some questionable language was flagged just last week by the director of this office for an upcoming publication on FASD. And importantly, our IC director, George Koob, and our deputy director, Trish Powell, are aware of the issue. And that's particularly because of conversations that George has had with Ken Jones and for Trish in her role as chair of the ICC-FASD. I will say that although NIAAA has not funded grants on specifically on the topic of stigma, we remain open to receiving applications involving stigma reduction interventions in order to build that evidence base we were talking about earlier. And we continue to look for opportunities to include this topic on future notices of special interest, which are what used to be program announcements, relevant to the areas of prevention and intervention research. I will add that to Kathy's point about paternal contributions, we are funding some grants in this area, and perhaps we need to do a better job at publicizing those findings and getting the word out about those papers. Some recent work of Michael Golding at the University of Texas comes to mind. So, you know, we can always do a better job. And I will add that, you know, representatives of the ICC-FASD are also aware of stigma, thanks to presentations on this topic by Ken, Kathy, and Tom. And I will say that the various federal agencies have discussed ways to increase awareness and improve health literacy around this topic. For example, I'm excited at the recent addition of ASPE to the ICC-FASD. For those that aren't aware, ASPE is the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation. The office is the principal advisor to the Secretary for HHS on policy development and is responsible for policy coordination and strategic planning across the department. Some of the people on this call were at a meeting that ASPE held last fall on FASD, and I'm happy to report that stigma was a topic widely discussed at that technical expert panel discussion. Now, I haven't seen the final report from that meeting, but my hope is that stigma will be included on an agenda of actionable items from that meeting. And so I'll end by saying that the Institute remains committed to reducing stigma around prenatal alcohol exposure, and we look forward to working with our researchers and our other federal partners to address this topic.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah. I don't know if Joe has any comments that he'd like to make. If not, I'd like
I don't have any comment. I'm just glad to hear about this.
We're glad to have you on, Joe. So I'm going to open it up to any questions that you might have related to the topic of stigma to any of the people who presented or anyone else. Bring up general ideas or your own thoughts and comments.
I just want to thank everyone for doing this. I actually thought it was really informative, seems like the wrong word to use, but I guess I just want to thank everyone for talking. Just frankly.
We appreciate that from the Bicentennial Medal winner this year.
thank you.
Celebration of Ireland's 200th anniversary.
Thank you, Ed.
That's quite a distinction. So
thank you. Thank you.
Any other comments? So within, if CFAS moved forward and had to come up with, or didn't have to come up with, but decided that we were interested in a focus or on one program on stigma that could interrelate with other projects, and had limited resources because CFAS is grossly underfunded for all that we do. You were supposed to smile, Bill. Thank you. Is it possible to, where would you put your focus?
Well, we had to make that, this is Ken, we had to make a decision about that in terms of the work that we did. And by we, I mean Kathy and Pat Corrigan and Peggy Combs-Way and so forth. And we decided that the best group to start out with was the medical profession. As I mentioned, pediatricians and obstetricians allegedly stigmatize pregnant women who are the biologic mothers of children with fetal alcohol syndrome and those kids more than anybody else in our society, which I'm very embarrassed to tell you. But we decided to start off with them as far as a focus to start
with. Can you put together an evaluation of that program? And then, for example, perhaps offer it as a Zoom CME project?
well, it's step six in what Sylvia was talking about, and it's one that we have had, I would say, more discussion about and more problem developing and thinking about than any of the other steps that she talked about. But yeah, we have gone round and round about how to evaluate this program, and we've come up with some things that we're going to be proposing in the grant that we have already submitted. but it's a very difficult thing to know how to evaluate a program such as this. Kathy, do you have any ideas?
Yeah, well, we've been working with Westat, and she has been evaluating our role in this process and looking at all the evaluations in terms of the birth mother presentations with the physicians and the outcomes on those. So she's actually presenting somewhere. So she has a significant amount of data from, you know, the past 3 years. Tom, do you have anything to add to that?
No, not to that piece, but
can you, before you start, wait, can you tell
me? I want to ask Sylvia a question, though, about as an international representative here on this call, I mean, do you think that there are differences in how stigma occurs in the various regions or countries and how it's dealt with that CFAS might be able to utilize to see what may be effective or what may be harmful?
I think that's a very good question, because when it comes to addressing stigma, I immediately think of the different types of stigma, because they're all interrelated. So to my opinion, one cannot simply go forward and addressing one type of stigma, because we might unintentionally provoke other types of stigma at the same time. Thinking about cultural differences, I don't think culture as such perhaps plays a role, but the method to culture definitely plays a role. So the approach that one wants to use in order to prevent stigma or prevention in general is very different when it comes to different populations, but also different ways of thinking. And that's why I'm thinking most strongly for the structural stigma. You know, some countries, we have different ways of addressing problems of not drinking during pregnancy, and more blaming people, or putting the emphasis on responsibility. But we know that doesn't work, and it might provoke the opposite effect. But we also see that in some types of communities, thinking about more indigenous communities, there is a different approach that one uses when it comes to prevention measures than non-indigenous communities. And the same goes even for my little country. We have a south part and a north part, and there is a huge difference when it comes to implementing methods between our regions even. So while thinking about implementation already, I think, to my opinion, it's too early to think about implementation. We are really looking at that wheel of the intervention approach that we use, as Ken also mentions. For us, it's still a matter of understanding of what is now the stigma we are talking about, and for whom are we talking about it, because the persons and the people who stigmatize, little do we know as to why they stigmatize, what the underlying perceptions are. And lessons can definitely be learned if we look at related health topics such as HIV, such as mental illness, such as substance use. We can learn a lot, and we see that we have not come as far as I would like to see it. But I'm also learning from the group in San Diego now. But I think, to answer your question, no, there is no one approach one can simply just adjust, as you have noticed also with prevention of FASD in general. We cannot just take one method that works for some communities just to implement it somewhere else. That's not possible. What is possible is the way of thinking about it, the process of problem identification to finding a solution. The process is always the same in addressing this, but the implementation of a method, it's not simply just applicable for everybody.
Okay, I see that we're losing some people off of here. I know that we're out of time. I'm willing to stay on if there are any other questions. I want to thank Sylvia for joining us and participating, and thank your mother for the use of her home. And I look forward to coming back and visit you someday when all this stuff is all over. So any other comments, questions?
Just one brief, just one example that I should have included in my comments is the fact that when we stigmatize a group of people, we want to take control. And for many of our women, the first thing that happens is they get their children taken from them. The same group of women never get offered any treatment or help support at all. So it's just, again, another example. What if, the question is, what if we actually got her treatment and worked to try to keep them together rather than just grabbing their kids and putting them in child protective services? Because for most women, treatment would work. Appropriate treatment would work. It can work, it does work, and it would work. So just wanted to say that.
Joanne, you had something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, whatever we do, or one way of approaching what we might do in CFAS is to build on Kathy and Tom and Ken and include the voice of lived experience. So it wouldn't be a research grant of the usual type, but the Vancouver conference to me is the epitome of that, where the adults are there, the birth mothers are there, caregivers are there, and you hear their voices, and that has changed people's perceptions. And so if we could incorporate something like that as part of what we do, and you see the success of it from Ken's comments and Kathy and Tom, and yes, so just a thought to think of it a little bit differently.
I think everybody knows that how I feel about the inclusion of NOFAS and their contribution to CFAS.
Right.
And that the importance of having them as an official component within CFAS. And I will say that over and over again, although I'm not sure what happens with that. But I think it's real important to get the input. And to, I mean, they're our closest link to stakeholders in helping us out. And so I think we need to keep encouraging that type of interaction.
Yeah, and if we're going to now think about stigma as one of the topics as we go forward, this is maybe a time where we could talk about how to reincorporate that.
Yeah. I mean, where CFAS 5 goes is still way up in the air, but this was a topic that I thought we should address. Sylvia's recent paper kind of led me down that line, and the fact that it was of interest to so many people involved in CFAS, I thought it was a good way to start the conversation. So, okay, thank you, everybody. Bill, I hope all your electrical problems are solved.
They are, thanks.
Okay, and let's see, any other, Sarah, we'll have to deal with yours next time because we're out of time. And thank you, everybody, and have a great day, and everyone stay safe and healthy, and you know, just take care of yourselves. All righty.
Thanks.
Bye, and thank you again, Sylvia. Really appreciate it. Applause, applause, applause. And
great job, Sylvia.
Thank you. Thank you.
Give my best to Leopold. I should have invited him.
I will. I will call him just now. So I will give you kind regards and stay well. I look forward to seeing you all soon.
I should have invited him to participate today. So I'm sorry. Give him my regrets and tell him I said hi. Thank you.
I will.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.
See you guys.
Bye.